Hey, Podnutsians. Welcome to Linux for the Rest of Us, episode 218. This is Door to Door Geek coming at you Tuesday, January the 2nd, 12:45 a.m., because why not? This is a Linux show all about Linux, from the most beginner amateur topic to trying to be more advanced topics when time permits and when the topic takes us there. But the first and foremost goal is to communicate Linux to the widest audience possible. First thing we're going to talk about this show is TechCon Unplugged. I ask people, do not forget TechCon Unplugged, September 20th through 22nd, Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's hosted by Jeff and Paco from Podnuts, the computer repair podcast, and Tech Life, soon to be rebranded Podnuts Daily again. And Paco is also on the computer business marketing podcast with Matt, two really nice guys focusing on the marketing side of owning your own business. TechCon Unplugged, September 20th through 22nd, Grand Rapids, Michigan. We're going to have basically all the food, all the drink covered for the complete two days. It's going to be at the Holiday Inn at the Grand Rapids Airport, aka as soon as you get off the plane, you're basically going to be there, and you're not going to have to travel blocks or miles from the event to your lodging. It is all in basically the exact same place, which I will say I am a fan of. I'm still going to try to get up in the morning and, to be honest, go for a walk at least now and then. But it looks like a very good place. Jeff and Paco are really good people. They even have a discounted airfare code if you use the link provided in the show. If you go to techconunplugged.com, I'm going to do everything in my power to make it there. And I do encourage, if you do want to hang out with Podnutsians, if you do want to hang out with smart people, if you do want to hang out with nice guys, if you're thinking about starting your own business, if you need any assistance in a computer related business, I think this is going to be one of the best places to go. And it's going to be one of the best places to where you can meet people, who are more knowledgeable than yourself, and, you know, get some things done. Completely forgot to turn that light on. Sorry about that, guys. This is streaming on YouTube. I will let you know, again, 12:48 a.m. And it is on Linux for the Rest of Us channel. It's not on the normal Door to Door Geek channel. It's not on the Podnuts channel. It's on a channel devoted just to Linux for the Rest of Us. I am not a fan of YouTube. I'm not a fan of the company. I'm not a fan of the way that they treat people. I'm not a fan of the way that they can cut people off. I'm not a fan of their monetization model. I am a fan of the simplicity they offer and the fact that it can be my double backup. I'm actually recording now three times, two on local machines and one up on YouTube. So I do appreciate that. Again, techconunplugged.com. I really do encourage everyone, if you want to have a really good time, it should be a really good time. Why don't we meet up there? Next link, I'm just going to jump basically through these links, one, two, three. Since it's now just myself on this show for at least now, I'm trying to do pre-preparation as much as possible to make the live show at least a little bit better. So I'm basically going to be just bouncing from link to link to link. But I want to first mention an email that we got, now that I remember, from Paul. And the email goes like this. Hello, just got through listening to an episode where you were saying that if you want to work basically anywhere in the world to learn Linux, I definitely put myself into that category. And I wanted to know if you had any more to say about that. You mentioned Linux Academy.com and some other site. I've recently sold my part in a business in Finland, which was refurbishing old computers and trying to focus on installing and supporting Ubuntu Mate. I worked at that for roughly 4 years and have plenty of troubleshooting experience for the typical home user, but would not say I am near to a sysadmin level expertise. Is sysadmin the kind of level you're thinking would allow you to work anywhere? I guess I just wanted to hear more about your ideas about how you think the Linux experience can help land a job. Wondering if you have some secret stash of Linux related jobs you know about or something. If you're still giving away copies of Larry's book, I would like to get one. Sorry if this is short. Would like to have more of a dialogue about this. But right now I'm limited to mobile phone writing as I am traveling in Japan without a laptop. Thanks and keep up the good work. Enjoy the podcast, Paul. I will say this. Without a laptop, I think you're crazy. We can help you with that. If you don't have your own hardware, again, Paul, contact me back. We can find a way to get you some kind of hardware because we need more than just a simple screen when we're traveling. Unless that's a choice you made. I will say that. Okay, let's go through this mail like piece by piece. Listening to where if you want to work anywhere, put them in that category. That's, I would say, awesome. Lennox Academy is still probably the number one place to go for very specialized Linux topics. And what I mean by that is Linux itself and basically not a lot of else you're going to learn there. But it is, I will say, one of the best. If you want generalized computer technology and Linux technology, I would say it's IT Pro TV. I'm not sure if in Finland or in Japan, either one is available, nor do I know if their prices are comparison to what could be offered locally. I will say this about Linux knowledge and the world. Everything you can ever imagine that you ever want to know about anything Linux related is completely out there. Everything software wise, basically you can download and you can play with in Linux, except for the extreme edge cases of like the super high end software used in movie rendering or specialized software in the Boeing pipeline of making airplanes or, you know, stuff like that you're not going to have access to. But everything in the middle tier of software and down or up, however you look at it, is going to be available to you, bam, off the internet with little issue. The only question is, do you know where it's at? Do you know what it's called? And after that, it's just a matter of copying it down to your local boxes. I will say you do need more spare hardware around if you want to get into sysadmin level of knowledge, because you have to have your own reproducible environment. Now, with the Linux Academy, I know you actually do get access to VM infrastructure hosted on Amazon where you can play around, create VMs, create domains, create different servers, connect them up, and, you know, have testing experience with them. That's not incredibly complicated whatsoever. And with the interface they offer, is actually, I want to say easy. I will not say easy. I'll say it's simple. If you have your own hardware, which you really don't need a lot of hardware for, I will say, like, for instance, right now, I have one of my rigs monitoring the YouTube stream. It's called a Odroid H2. It's an X86 mini board, 115 millimeters by 115 millimeters in size. So it's not big. I'd pick it up if it wasn't running, where it can take a max of 32 gigs of RAM. Okay. The board itself is only like 110, 115 bucks. It can take a maximum up to 32 gigs of RAM. With 32 gigs of RAM, you could literally have easy 40, 50, or 60 virtual machines on that box. You can emulate a lot of different environments, a lot of different architectures, and you can learn a lot about sysadmin kind of things. To me, the biggest jump from doing help desk type thing to more of a sysadmin type thing is just communicating with multiple computers or synchronizing communication with multiple computers. You're still doing a lot of the same troubleshooting and solution finding out. Definitely there are differences, especially in the software that you use, more of the LDAP kind of thing, more of the network protocols, more of the SSHs. But the basic fundamentals of troubleshooting is the same basic fundamentals of troubleshooting. So that's the good thing. And if you have a genuine interest, you can do it. All you need is extra hardware. And if you're not even having a laptop when that you travel, I think you need to contact me back and we need to try to help you out somehow, is what I'll say, because you need more hardware if you want to learn. And you were talking about using Ubuntu Mate with focusing on installing and supporting. it almost doesn't matter what you pick. And what I mean by that is, as long as you're comfortable supporting it, and as long as it's easy for you to teach somebody else how to support it. The real goal when you get into business is to not be doing whatever you're starting to do. When you start a business offering support, you are going to offer support. But then very quickly, your goal should be, I don't want to offer the support anymore. I want to hire somebody else to offer the support. I want to move up my ranks, move up my priorities, move up my job task to a more complicated job is what I'll say. So you have to be okay with teaching somebody else how to do that very same thing. And if you pick something like Ubuntu Mate, to be honest, you have a good broad spectrum of people to pick from versus if you were just supporting, say, Slackware. So I think that's a fine pick to do, especially if you're comfortable with doing it. But you have to also focus on creating support material to teach others so they can do that job as well. Secret stash of Linux-related jobs. There is no such thing as a secret stash of anything related jobs. It's just job search engines, whether you're on the Microsoft-owned LinkedIn or whether you just use headhunters in like the contract type world, which I'm so happy I don't have to deal with. Oh my goodness, it sounds painful. I've had the same job for 23 years. I don't go search for jobs because I don't need to search for jobs. I started out stacking 50-pound boxes of license plates from cars onto pallets. That's literally how I started my career in this 23 year. Now I'm basically in software development. I do database development. I help with the system administration of the network. I do some SharePoint development. I do some of almost everything. There is no secret stash. All it takes is a little bit of work, a little bit of effort, a little bit of searching wherever you're at. Because here's the thing, what I know how to find a job, let's say in Maryland and the people I do help get jobs, it's not going to help you much in Japan, I'm pretty sure. The only good thing I can tell you about right now in Japan is the population is literally going down. There's literally a shortage of people. The older generation is dying off and the younger generation are not populating their regions back up at the same pace. So there's literally a population loss. I will say there is no such thing as like a bad market to be in. There's just, where do you find how you can be beneficial in such an environment? Right now, the need for automation in Japan is going to go off the chart. This is January 2nd, 2019. I can't remember. I can't believe I knew the right year, but yeah, it's January 2nd, 2019. This is the quote unquote, the year of automation in Japan. If there's ever an opportunity to make money in Japan, I say learn automation. And honestly, the easiest avenue right now to learn automation, I would probably say, is Python. Python and boards like the ESP266 or similar nature, cheap hardware, because this country you're in, Japan, is going to need as much help as it can possibly get to help with as many things as possible, because with the population shrinking means you're going to have more things done quicker and in more of an automated fashion. That I feel unbelievably confident about is what I'm going to say. For those that don't know, for those that don't listen to DDG, there's definite different information about me and my Linux environment over there. Here's a for instance. I am like habitually addicted to listening to things. Yesterday, I listened to 21 hours and 55 minutes of podcast. Last week, I listened to 5 days worth in 22 hours. So basically 6 days of podcast. In December 2018, I listened to 24 days and 20 hours worth of podcast. That doesn't count all the news. Sometimes, some days in news, I listen to easily 4-5+ hours worth of news because I listen to everything sped up. The podcasts are now at about 4x. So when I say 24 hours, I mean 8 hours worth of listening. And my news right now, the fastest it goes is 2x. So if I say 10 hours worth of news, that's only 5 hours worth of listening. Japan needs automation, period. There's no magic technology for it. The main reason I would suspect Linux would do better over there is because it's a freely distributable, easily reproducible environment. So I'd say learn automation. Hardware like the ESP266 cost literally pennies for you to invest in, test with, play with. But automation is a great way, I would say, right now in that country to make lots and lots of money. If you need a copy of Larry's book, I just need to know what country's Amazon that you use, because I don't actually have copies of the book. I can buy you Amazon gifts, and I can say, send this to Amazon.jp or whatever country you're in and get you the book. And if anybody else out there wants a copy of the book and cannot afford it, do not hesitate. Let me know. I have about $300 hosting bill come up, which I will say thank you to Christian. Thank you to a bunch of people is what I'll say. There's no doubt I'm going to be able to pay it with no real stress whatsoever. So that's good. And hopefully by the end of February, I'll be able to buy a couple of these people books. Because Larry Bushy's book on how to use Ubuntu Mate, I think are some of the better written things that I put my time into reading. It's put in a very simple manner, easy to understand, easy to digest, easy to consume, and easy to comprehend. Again, Going Linux is the podcast. Larry Bushy is the author. He now has, I think, 3 books out. The digital versions are actually, I think, quite affordable, and physical versions are actually quite fairly priced is what I'll say. I will try to make sure to have links to them in the notes. I will say right now they're not in the notes. And since right now I'm doing everything basically live, it's not going to be in the notes because I'm doing the show. Okay, next link here is 8 tips to help Linux, to help non-techies move to Linux. This is an unbelievably, as far as I'm concerned, touchy thing to even talk about because there's nothing about it that is easy. And nothing about it is absolute. Every single person you ever meet will have different needs, different desires, different assumptions, and they'll want different things from their network, from their operating system, whether it be laptop, netbook, desktop, or anything else. But I will say, I do think this is a fine read. I'm not going to say it's a great read. I'm not going to say it's perfect. It's the best information I've ever seen, but it definitely brings certain things up that you might not have thought of, is the way I'll put it. Because of that alone, I'll say it is a good read. It's by Scott Nesbitt. I love the name Nesbitt. I want to say one of the guys from the TV show The Monkees, and you know the music group The Monkees, was a Nesbitt. So Scott Nesbitt will always be mentioned on my show. This was actually also not a brand new. Oh yeah, this was about 2 weeks old content, but still very good. The number one thing I'll say I do like about this in this article is their number one thing to do, which is be honest about Linux. There is no magic pill for weight loss. There is no special thing you can do that will do anything special. Be honest about Linux. It is not perfect. It is exploitable. It can experience failure. The hard drive might fail on you. The OS might fail on you. Updates might break things. Updates might come slow. Things might just, you know, stop working. Linux is not perfect. Don't pitch it like it's perfect. Number two, it says it isn't about you. I will say this is I was wondering why they put this here. It definitely confused me, but we're just going to skip that one. Not everyone is a techie. Take stock in their hardware. That means you have to go look at the hardware because everyone is not a techie. I will say it's very difficult to put something in such a way that every user will be able to comprehend it. This is where a genuine friendship and kinship needs to be made and genuine conversation needs to happen. Every time somebody asks you a question as a subject matter expert, you should reply with at least 20 questions. When they ask you, what's the best Linux distribution I should use? Which of course they won't ask. They'll say, what Linux should I use? Or how can I use Linux? Because they don't even know that there's different versions. You have to come back with lots of different questions. Like, you know, their hardware. How old is their hardware? Because you can't ask them what's their processor, what's their RAM, what's their hard drive, because they have no idea. So you have to ask very basic questions. Then you have to ask them, do you have a printer? Do you have a scanner? You know, is having a webcam and like Skype type calls important? Do you need a optical drive? Do you need to be able to write disk? You know, keep asking questions. And literally after 20 or so questions, you should have an idea of what they expect out of their computer. Of course, everybody's going to want either Facebook or Twitter or YouTube. That goes without saying. But then you have to ask people, do you have a password manager? And if they shrug their shoulders, this is a great opportunity for you to introduce them to the idea of centrally managed passwords. Then that will allow them to have more complex passwords, which is always a good thing. Number six, help them test drive some distros. This is not as easy as it sounds, because to actually help them test drive distros means you have to basically, you know, keep giving them bootable material, either CDs, DVDs, or thumb drives, and going through them the process of booting to that one, booting to this one. Now, just going through that exercise alone is going to help them understand that they, as an operating system on their computer, they can boot to different media. That is one of those things they might not have ever heard of. And just doing that repetitively over and over again, hypothetically over a week or two, should literally open their eyes to some of the possibilities they can have. Nobody wakes up one day and understands everything about computers in Linux. Nobody has, nobody ever will. This is the kind of gradual process that people have to digest. People have to take things in. People have to experience things themselves. And this, I think, is a really good way. And it keeps going, 6, 7, 8, final thoughts kind of thing. This was actually a pretty good article. This was at opensource.com by Scott Nesbitt, 8 tips to help non-techies move to Linux. I literally encourage people to check this out. This will be in the notes. Again, everything I mention, I try to put in the notes. And if I skip things from the notes, don't hesitate to call me out. And I encourage everyone out there, call out your podcaster, because it's A, all communication's good, but B, keep them honest. Make sure that they're doing their due diligence and their own part to try to be honest to themselves and do actually a little bit of work and document what they're talking about. This next one is from Linux.com. And I saw this and I almost laughed, cackled, like, what are we going to see? And it was 4 unique terminal emulators for Linux. Unique terminal. Well, technically speaking, if you just change the default color, it's a unique terminal. Okay, so just to say unique terminal emulators makes me a little skeptical about what I'm going to see. So I click on it and I go through. And the very first one is one I've never heard of, Tilda, which is a drop-down GTK terminal, kind of like Quake, where you hit a button and then voila, this terminal appears magically out of your screen and it's always there. It's just hidden. That's fine. There's nothing special about that. When you use something like i3, which is what I'm using for like the last now well over a year, the idea of a drop-down terminal is not sexy whatsoever. So I look at that and I laugh. Okay, I haven't heard of it, but is it really that special? Go to the next one. It's A, and it's A term. We've all seen a term. I think there's nothing really special about it. It is extremely customizable, but it starts out extremely bland, which means you're going to have to take some work to make it look anything different. Then there's E term, which is basically the same kind of thing. I think it's one of those ones that's been around forever. Nothing special about it at all. Then I expected Terminator or something else I've heard of a million times, but no, they actually caught me off guard with this one, and it's extra term, extraterm, and it does something, honestly, not spectacular, not fancy dancy, no razzle dazzle, no shamil shamazzle, no nothing like that, but I actually thought it was actually appealing. And that is, if you have a command that takes over one line to type, which we've all seen the overflow and it go down to the next line, this one actually gives you a little visual indicator that your line is wrapped around the screen. I thought that kind of thing was actually really interesting. On top of that, it also highlights commands that worked and commands that didn't work different colors. So if I type sudo and I spell apt wrong, install Firefox, and I hit enter, because I spelled it wrong, that line will then appear red in my history when I'm looking at it in that same terminal. That, I think, is actually awesome. Okay. And then there was also a little bit extra it did in the default coloring of the terminal. I will say I'm using coloring a lot now in my terminals just as a visual indicator, so I don't have to, you know, devote a lot of brain cells to sitting there thinking everything through from beginning to end. So extra term is one that I'm literally going to install and I'm literally going to play with, because I do like being able to have that instantaneous feedback of color. It's just another way for me to get information back from the terminal without going through a lot of detailed reading and examining of lines and things. So I definitely like that a lot. Next one I'm going to bring up is another one that honestly caught my eye as being almost hokey, as almost being, have we heard this before? And then as I looked at it, I thought, this is actually really cool and it looks really small file size. Okay. This one was over at, todaygeek.com. I don't know if you've ever heard of that website. But it's called Term2SVG, TermToSVG. Record your terminal sessions as an SVG animation in Linux. Okay. SVG animation is a vector graphics type animation, which means it's vector in nature, which means it's infinitely scalable because it's nothing more than raw data. It's raw numbers. It isn't a like bitmap, a raster of the actual image itself, which means it's not an actual image. It's merely the numbers representative of the image, which I don't know if you can get that, but what I get out of that is incredibly small file size in comparison to actual video, which is a really good thing. My logic is for most of the world where there's not super fast internet. I will say, the only thing I think would scare me about this a little bit was I think you had to install, this was through Python, so I'm not as scared. Okay. For a second, I thought it was a Node thing. Node things on me always break. I mean, like always break. But it, basically all you got to do is a sudo apt install python-pip. Because of this website, they actually do give you the different ways to do it on Arch, Fedora, CentOS, OpenSUSE, and a bunch of other things. And then basically you have to install sudo pip install term2svg space pyte space python-xlib and svgwrite. And you type that out. And then in air quotes, voila, you can then basically just type term2svg, hit enter, and it will basically start to record your session. You can then simply hit control D when you're done doing your recording of the terminal, and it saves it out to a SVG file. And they even have an example of the SVG file being displayed on the web page. The good and the bad is it's extremely small file size with an extremely crisp image of what everything that happened on that terminal, from the terminal itself, as you're typing, letters are like popping up in real time, and the results of that terminal session come back also in real time. I think this is actually awesome. I think this is actually cool. I think this can be an extremely useful tool to show people how you did X, Y, or Z. The only problem is you have to remember everything is in real time. So literally, if you type a word and then look away for 10 seconds and then come back and type the second word, when the person's watching that video, in air quotes, that animation, they're going to have to wait that 10-second gap. So that's the only bad thing I'll say about this, is that it is in real time, but it's good that it's in real time to the same degree, okay? This, I think, is actually really awesome. I can see this being really helpful. I've never heard of todaygeek.com, the number todaygeek.com. But this is actually, I think, a fine article they have posted on their website, and I'm happy I could find it. Now, the next thing is that medium.freecodecamp.org. This is what you do if you're in a multi-user environment and you guys use Linux and you really want to get to the other administrator or other coworker. You want to drive them absolutely crazy. I think this is a good article for you. There are some users out there who I think would like this and use this. I'm not sure I'm one of these people, but I'm going to at least keep this link handy for my own good. It is, again, at medium.freecodecamp.org, and it's how to Christmasify your terminal and shell. And yes, I said Christmasify, because we all know that's a real word, right? And what is that? What this enables you to do, it enables you to put to customize your terminal session even with emojis. I said emojis. in 2019. I did it. There, right there is the first time. And it also will allow you to do some really in-depth color customizations onto that terminal session. So if you insist that your terminal has little Christmas presents and little Christmas trees and the beginning text is in green and the ending text is in red, well, then you found the exact page for you. It's at freecodecamp.org. I'm going to keep it just so when I need to make somebody mad, I'm going to insert random emojis into their own terminal session. They won't know what happened because it's simply just stored in the local .bash RC file. So that's easy to, you know, manipulate. Here's another one. Okay. This one, I've been finding almost hokey type articles that are hokey, but then when I look at them, they're actually better because I'm so used to article headings, headlines lying to me. I just expect them to keep lying to me over and over and over again. This one is at Hackaday. Being at least busy, interested, whatever you want to put it, having fun in 3D printing, I will say, I'm definitely having fun printing different things. And Hackaday is one of those websites that I will say I find really useful, really helpful, and just keeping me up to date. But this one was Lennox Foo, share the terminal in your browser. And I almost thought, again, I want to say this was misleading because it doesn't actually share the terminal in the browser if you read it. What it is able to do, it's able to send a terminal session's output to a read-only browser instance. Okay, so you can take read-only terminal output and have it instantaneously with no work, no effort being displayed on a dedicated web server. Okay, so what I mean by that is I can simply, like, on my one, let's say my mini computer running my Nextcloud instance, I can just have start up in the very beginning of the a server. I could have HTOP hypothetically start in this terminal session using this tool, and it will be displayed on port 8080 on that computer. I'm pretty sure you can customize the port, but by default it's on 8080, and it's called GOTTY is the name of the application. So basically I could just say GOTTY and then HTOP, and then voila, my entirety of the HTOP screen would then be at the IP address of that computer colon 8080, and it's just done. I didn't have to set up Nginx. I didn't have to set up any other web servers. I didn't have to change any permissions. I didn't have to change any HTML, nothing. I simply just run the command and it displays the output of the terminal into a custom spurred web server that has read-only terminal stuff back to it. It has minor encryption and minor authentication on it. It's something you should not have public facing, is what I will say, no matter what. You can have it, it says in a multi-user environment, you can make it to where it will automatically only have one session spurred at only one time. It also makes it sound like you can actually share your current desktop session. This is what I found almost interesting. So hypothetically, if I am on the same network, here we get back to the admin kind of thing. If I'm a network administrator and on my network, I have users running Linux, I could have GOTTY installed by default, GOTTY, and I could have a globally set hotkey in their bash RC or some other file that whenever they hit Control Alt Shift plus D, D for display or something, then I could have a custom web server spur up showing their current desktop in a read-only fashion as a really quick troubleshooting of, do I need to do anything? So you could have the user submit a ticket, you call them up and say, hey, this is blah, blah, blah from blah, blah, blah. Do me a favor. Is your computer up and running? Okay. Does it seem like it's screens on? Is the mouse moving? They say, yes. Okay. Do me a favor. Hold down Control and Shift and Alt all at the same time, and then press the letter D while you're holding down those keys. And as long as you know that computer, there's no reason why you also cannot know that user's computer and that user's IP address, because if you're a proper system administrator, all that should be discoverable, searchable, and or even hard-coded on the computer itself. So, and then you should have a record of that. And then voila, you can see their entirety of their desktop. And in some cases, and what I mean by some cases, maybe even upwards of 70% of all help desk calls could be instantaneously ended with no extra software needed, no extra connections needed, no extra communications needed. You simply have them hit those buttons. You see what's on their screen. You then tell them what to type, or you can SSH into their computer and, oh, they need this installed kind of thing. And then just have them log out, log back in, and voila, the issue is done. This can be, could be an unbelievably helpful tool for those kinds of people. For someone like me, I can almost see having the output of this being displayed on almost like an e-ink kind of low power display where I only need it to like visually update maybe once every minute, once every couple minutes. Sometimes your goal as a network monitor is not to have everything in clear text, but to actually have something in an image format. And this looks like that's what this could be really good for, getting back a output from a terminal or an application or a window or a desktop in just a image format. So I definitely like the idea of this. Again, it's Gotty, G-O-T-T-Y. The link to the Hackaday article will be in the notes. I didn't immediately see a link to anything on GitHub or anything, but I'm sure it's there. Just got to click it and go for it is what I'll say. Next, this one is actually something I feel, let's just say, strongly about. Okay, I'm going to read, honestly, most of this verbatim because I just found this to be a good article, well-written, short, precise, to the point. I can't ask for anything more over on Veronix, and it's by Michael Lairbell, and it is called Microsoft Had Another Big Year of Open Source Surprises. Okay, I'm just going to comment on the first part, and then I'm going to read it. It says, basically, 2015, they started to support VP9 open source codec. They started to embrace Clang and LLVM. In 2016, they launched SQL Server on Linux. So I can tell you guys this right now. There's no doubt in my mind back in then 2015, 2016, I mentioned the fact that Microsoft SQL Server was coming to Linux. I will say it has been as successful as anybody could have expected it to be. It is successful. It's just not greatly successful. People are using it. Not everybody is using it, but it is still on Linux and it is still being ran on Linux. 2018, I will say they kind of went a little crazy. I don't know who could have foreseen this kind of year at Microsoft. I honestly don't believe people at Microsoft. I don't believe there's even one person at Microsoft, much less a multitude of people, who could have seen 2018 shape up as it did, starting with Microsoft continuing to use Git and then turning around and buying GitHub. That was really big news as far as I'm concerned. They also re-released some of the old MS-DOS sources on GitHub. Again, that kind of shocked me. Microsoft joined the Open Innovation Network, and to do such required them to basically release some patents. From what I understand, they released over 60,000 patents, which I do believe was over, above, and beyond what they needed to release. They did not release those critical Android licenses that make it every time somebody installs Android, they get some money back. So it was a olive leaf. Nonetheless, where they did release some patents, no shape, way, or form did they give up all their patents. If they gave up 60,000 patents, there's little doubt in my mind they had 6 million patents or more originally. So to give up 60,000 is not the end of the world. I'm sure they were very, very particular about which patents they did give up. They also ordered, it says one of the most immediate winners of this was ClearType subpixel font rendering, which I will say, for years after installing a Linux, if they wanted to do certain things with text, you really had a much better experience when you installed the Microsoft TrueType font. So I will say anything involving fonts being open is going to help every computer user. So I definitely like that. They also are adding OpenSSH, the command curl and tar to Windows 10. That is really, honestly, would not have guessed it in a million years. Also, in the upcoming Windows Server 2019, they also are incorporating Kubernetes, and OpenSSH support is going to be in Windows 10 as well. So now, the manner of communicating from any major desktop to any major server, you can do with OpenSSH and using stuff like Kubernetes on the Windows 2019 platform. So that means a lot of the Linux knowledge that people have been learning over the last couple of years will actually become beneficial and usable in the Windows world. There's no doubt the amount of money Linux techs got in the past was more money than Windows techs. That's just the fact. Having these kinds of things incorporated into Windows, make no guesses about it, make no assumptions about it, it helps Windows. It does not help OpenSSH. It does not help curl. It does not help tar. It does not even, well, it will help Kubernetes as a brand, but it's not going to help them do anything in particular. They also, now here's the ones that really got me to at least open my eyes. I believe this is the one. They added more distributions to the Windows subsystem for Linux. Okay, that's fine. They also added the copy paste support. Okay, wait a minute. I guess that's just fine. They have a Linux powered Azure Sphere iOS platform, aka Microsoft truly released their own version of Linux. That's what that means. That, I don't know. I don't know if I could have called it beginning of 2018, but that did happen. They also released AZ software for Linux, which I do believe is to help Linux people move more easily to the Azure platform. Windows Notepad finally supports Unix line endings. This has been a true pain for a lot of people for a lot of years. That when you were editing Unix files or Linux files, you could not do it in Notepad because they did not do line endings, carriage feeds correctly. So anytime you had to edit one of their files, you had to use a different note editor. So for the default Windows Notepad, aka the tool that hasn't seen a significant upgrade in probably 20 years, is now getting an upgrade to support Unix line endings, is pretty much done. Unix and Linux are now here officially to stay. Nobody can say anything about it. They also offered PowerShell. It was being offered as a Ubuntu snap, which I will say, don't know if I could have seen that coming. It also became possible to profile .NET applications on Linux. This enables .NET developers to do even more of the core development cycle, the life cycle of .NET application development on Linux. So it's getting to be the point you don't even need a Windows computer to make quote-unquote Windows software. They also introduced a open-sourced shader conductor graphics. I don't even know what the hell that is. It might be something important by version 3. Old-timers will get that. But here's the one that really got me. In December, earlier this month, they also open sourced Windows Forms, WinUI, and Windows Presentation Foundation, WPF. That is really monumental because this is a lot of the core functionality and the core constructs and the core building blocks of .NET. And what I mean is you could have did everything in .NET just using their default C# interpreter programs. What the Windows Presentation Foundation is, it's more like a framework to where it allows for more rapid development because you can offload some of the more detail specific things like how to draw objects onto that library. So they're releasing more libraries on Linux as well. Now, it's good for them to do this. It's definitely an olive branch for them to do this, but this is the beginning of vendor lock-in. what we need on the Linux side is not to have these libraries open sourced. We need the actual making of these libraries and the control of these libraries to be open sourced. We need the control and manipulation of these libraries to be outside of the corporate envelope. Thus, truly, then everybody in the open source world can actually trust these libraries in development cycle. Until then, it's fine that they released them. It sure does look good on paper. It sure does look good on a headline on some website. But it actually doesn't do anything to change any, as far as I'm concerned, fundamental stance on freedom, liberty, open software, and proprietary closed source corporate software. Two of the other things that are of note is they also are rebuilding their Edge browser on top of Chromium Engine. I'm using Firefox more than ever, is all I'll say to that. Because now, no doubt, the number of Chromium users are going to skyrocket, which just means more of a attack platform. More people will be desirable into hacking and finding exploits on such a platform. So I'm now using Firefox. The last one I never heard of was most recently they said they're going to help work on a new open sourced UEFI alternative. This just shows how this is not a Microsoft. I don't think anybody could have foreseen a year ago. They're working on a new open source UEFI alternative. They were the ones that basically started up this whole UEFI secure boot aspect. So now for them to be doing this, it's definitely whoever is in charge and whoever is making decisions is definitely not the same person a year ago, or actually probably 2 or 3 years ago, making those decisions. So things are changing, but there's things that are not going to change with Microsoft. For instance, they report to the shareholders. Their main interest is to the shareholders. Their ideals are to the shareholders. Their beliefs are to the shareholders. Everything they do is towards the shareholders. They do not want to make things better for the end user because they love end users. They're not going to try to make things any different for the end user because they're end users. They're going to do whatever they have to do whatever they have to do to make as much money for the shareholders. And that's just what they do. That's, you know, there's no surprises. There's no differences. There should be no shock at all that that's what they do, but that's what they do. Making one little tweak there to the YouTube video. Like one or two more links here. Yeah, two more links here. The next one is Mozilla revives Mozilla Labs. Sorry, I was a bit distracted there. Let me take care of that. Mozilla revives Mozilla Labs. Now, they've been doing this almost off and on now for like a year or two. Because it actually was back in, I believe, 2014, yeah, when they ended Mozilla Labs. And what Mozilla Labs was almost like Google Email Labs, where you could create little snippets of code, and if they were good enough and they were smart enough and doggone it, people liked them, and they would look at making them back into the full-fledged product. That's kind of what Mozilla Labs was. Well, Mozilla Labs is now doing a couple things, I'll say, very different. Right now, if you go to labs.mozilla.org, you'll see there's a couple projects up there. Among them, like one of them is the Firefox Share Prospector Test Pilot Ubiquity. There's something else called Ubiquity. So there are things up there like the Firefox Reality Browser, which is a 3D VR, not augmented reality, VR browsing experience, aka you've got the old time like stick walking through a 3D world and you tap your stick and point your stick and stuff works. You have a poker. So they're definitely reopening the idea of doing more than just a browser. And I will say this, Firefox needs to do a hell of a lot more better every day, or else every day they're going to be losing and losing popularity, losing traction, losing users, losing mindshare. You're always going to have a certain subnet of people out there looking for alternative browsers. Right now, Firefox is the best we have, closest thing we have to a mainline browser with actual community pushing ideals behind it. Yes, Mozilla is a private company. Yes, Mozilla makes a profit. Yes, yeah, I know that. But I can't think of any other full-fledged, full-featured browser that actually takes input from the community like Mozilla. They also have one of the big things is like the Mozilla IoT thing that they have going on over there. And I will say I've heard more than a couple people talk about that. That is something I am at least mildly interested in. And I say only mildly interested in because everything about the idea of IoT just means to me you're going to lose a little bit of control, a little bit of ownership, a little bit of everything that you do. But hopefully if Mozilla helps support a IoT infrastructure, they at least acknowledge who should be in control of it and where your data goes by default. Like Steve Gibson said, the tyranny of the default is a very true thing. If by default all your information goes out into the public internet, into some server that we do not have root over, then that's how everything is going to be, because that's what happens. Default is how people run all their things. So I'm going to try to check out Mozilla Labs. Hopefully there's a couple of things there I think are cool. I know Firefox Share is the kind of things I've used multiple times in the past. It actually works really good. Hopefully some of their other projects will work just as good. I like the idea of supporting smaller browser makers. The last thing I'm going to talk about really quick is called Pulse Effects. All you got to know is that there's people out there who have always hated Pulse, and there's no changing their mind. But for the other people out there who honestly like the idea that PAVU control exists and it allows us to custom manipulate our sound infrastructure virtually with clicks and dragging, and it's pretty easy to use. I mean, it's not the best piece of software ever, but it enables me to enable other people to do certain things on their audio stack in a very short period of time, where in previous generations of sound infrastructure, it would have been much more difficult to do. So I'm a personal fan of Pulse Audio. PAVU control, I think, is great. Now what Pulse Effects does is it basically adds into another application a limiter, a compressor, reverberation, equalizer, and audio volume effects for Pulse Audio applications. There's no other way to put it, as this can only be a good thing. It is no jack. This is not supposed to be like a jack alternative. Jack is extremely advanced extremely useful tools for extremely advanced users. It is not incredibly new user friendly. Pulse seems to be a little bit more new user friendly, I'll say, than Jack. Everything I'll say looks good. Everything looks fine. I like the idea of having Pulse being able to do things like limiter, like compressing and stuff like that. This looks like an actual really good tool for an audiophile wanting to do a little bit more customizations with your Pulse Audio. The full list of application output is limiter, audio gain, expander, compressor, multiband compressor, equalizer, bass enhancer, exciter, crystallizer, reverb, crossfeed, filter, low pass, high pass, band reject modes, stereo tools, loudness, maximizer, pitch, gate, multiband gate, de-esser, and convolver. Don't know what that is, but the high pass and low pass filters are extremely helpful. If you have somebody who has a low constant hum in the background, I believe it's the high pass will get rid of that. High pass lets the high stuff pass, not the low stuff. So if you have a low hum in the background constantly, a high pass filter can fix that. If you have a little squeal in the background constantly, like a very off in the distant high squeal, a low pass can get rid of all that. And a de-esser is one of those tools I encourage people only look into if you're okay with doing a lot of work. Because once you learn about a de-esser and you learn how many times people say the letter S or the S sound and it's too strong compared to the other sound, then you might not want to look at de-essing because it is a non-stop kind of task. I think this is really cool. I think this is a really smart thing to do. Right now, you can easily install it on Arch, Void, Gentoo, Rosa, and on and Alt Linux in the community package. They do have some Ubuntu and Debian information. Looks like you can add it easily as a flat pack as well, which is the more of the Fedora format. So I definitely like the idea of this. I want to play with this. I want to look at this, but I also want to have enough time to do everything else I need to do. This looks definitely damn cool is what I'll say. I want to thank everyone for the email. We did have like one or two other emails. They were basically just emails saying thank you, to which I almost laugh. No, thank you. Because without you guys providing feedback, I'm pretty sure I would not be doing more shows. In fact, I'd probably be doing less shows, or I would just be doing different shows. If you want to contact this show, if you want to send feedback, the easiest way is podcast@lennoxfortherestofus.com. If you want to send me a personal email, you can send me the email at mail@podnuts.com. If you would like to send a voicemail to this show, the easiest way is 7076podnut. If you would like to send in an audio file, there should be no real limits on the size of the audio. The one thing I will say out there is I really do encourage everyone, if you need somebody to talk to, if you have any kind of depression going on, and if you just need to communicate with other people, listen to the last episode of DDG. I do give out personal information in that episode, and I have no problem chatting with people out there if you need anything, or if you just want to chat. I believe it was episode 19. And I do encourage people out there, be skeptical about your Linux shows. Question them. You need to question them a hell of a lot more. I'll put it like this. I've heard so many Linux podcasts in the last 3-4 months say so many factual incorrect things and state them as facts. It honestly makes me very, very discomforting. I'll say this, Klaatu, GNU World Order, you got nothing to worry about. That guy has the uncanny ability to speak continuously and yet freely and yet very accurately. He's the kind of guy with enough experience behind him and enough comprehension behind him. When he listens, I love looking up what he's talking about, because it always validates to, yes, he's exactly right. But there's a lot of other podcasts out there. There's a lot of other really bad podcasts out there. There's a lot of other bad YouTube channels out there that more people need to question. And I'm not telling anybody to do anything I wouldn't do. And what I mean by that, I mean exactly what you think I mean by that. I call out a lot of people. I privately message a good amount of shows. I send DMs. I send YouTube messages. I send emails. I send voicemails. Again, I listen to over 150 podcasts in a week. I listen to over 5 days worth of audio in a week. I also send a hell of a lot of feedback. And it's funny how when I question the people on being completely inaccurate, I get something back that basically completely moves the target. They talk about something on their show, I directly respond to what they talked about on their show, and then only via email, they then change the target. Well, what I meant was something else. Don't tell me you meant something else. Tell everybody who listened you meant something else. Okay? Don't just try to correct yourself privately in an email, because publicly you still sound wrong. So podcasters need to acknowledge when they're wrong. Podcasters need to come out when they're wrong, because as far as I'm concerned, when you don't, you're still wrong to everybody else, and you're spreading bad information, false information, misinformation. Linux is not perfect. We are not good. Somebody else is not evil. There's no absolute black and white when dealing with anything that's not binary, like code, zeros and ones. Code is zeros and ones. That's all it is. There's nothing else. There is no between. This is not quantum computers. This is normal computers, zero or one. So people need to also stop putting political speech into their podcast. Like, there's a good reason why I stopped listening to the Mintcast like 2 or 3 years ago, because every other episode had political jargon and political message and political beliefs and political ethnicity is what I'll put pushed all through it. I'm going to try it again just because I hear other people are on the show now. So, hey, maybe they changed. But hey, maybe you shouldn't call yourself Mintcast, or maybe you should call it Mintcast 2.0, or maybe you should just do something different. To associate yourself with people that have blatantly put their political belief out there is not going to be good for you as a new person. AKA, if I was all of a sudden, Clem left Lennox Mint and I was involved with Lennox Mint, the first thing I would do is change the name Lennox Mint, because I wouldn't want anything associated with anti-Semitic people, people who have openly declassed an entire race, culture, religion of people. I would want to distance myself from them as much as possible. But people apparently don't think it's that big of a deal. We all have to pick our battles. I understand some people still use Mac. Some people still use Windows. I know some people are still okay with people being anti-Semitic. Some people are still okay with people calling entire countries of people evil. I mean, let's stop and think for a second. Does our own current president represent the entirety of our nation? And the answer is obviously no. What makes you think any other public-facing side of another country is the actual accurate representation of everyone within that country? Whether it be China, whether it be Japan, whether it be Korea, whether it be Russia, whether it be Mexico, or whether it be Canadoadia, they're not an accurate representation of all the people. All the people are much more like us than what we see in those leaders. Less is people stop calling the entirety of other countries evil, because they're not. They're people. Their leaders might be dumb and doing bad things, but that doesn't mean everyone in that country is. And I beg people, whatever you do, do not forget. It isn't that we can't trust Facebook. It isn't that we can't trust Instagram, same company. It isn't that we can't trust Twitter. It isn't that we can't trust Google. It isn't that we can't trust Microsoft. It isn't that we can't trust Apple. It isn't that we can't trust any of these other companies. It's that we have to know who has root. Because if you do not have root, you do not know who does. And I'll talk to everyone again in a couple weeks.